Yeah, one of the things which I feel is very important that is actually now Labour Group policy is that we do look at re-establishing council housing within Preston for the first time since 1983.
I thought Gateway was sorting some of that. I thought that's their responsibility now.
That is a good point, Paul, because we were forced by the government to meet what was known as a decent home standard. So every single social property, which were council properties at the time, would have a decent, you know, kitchen, double glazing, bathroom and all the rest of it. So we were forced to actually get up to that standard to transfer it to Community Gateway.
Because you couldn't afford to do it under the original housing scheme.
We could have possibly just about afforded to do it, but there was a disincentive for councils to keep the properties. So in some ways we were blackmailed by the government, I feel, at the time, to actually do this, you know.
A Labour government,
yeah. Yeah, which you know, I'm critical and openly critical of the policy on housing because it has discriminated against council housing. So that is something we did, and obviously I had to vote with that because it was my party's policy to get the existing stock up to the decent home standard. Now, that's in the past, but what's happened in the last couple of years, after a lot of pressure from trade unions and others within the Labour Party, is there are now new freedoms for councils to build council housing again. For example, under the old system, If you received rents and right to buy receipts from your council housing stock, 75% of the right to buy receipts or 25% of the rents would have to go back to the central government. Now, after pressure from trade unions in the Labour Party and others, it's, you know, councils can now keep the full rents and right to buy receipts. They can also bid along with housing associations for housing corporation money, which I think is 10.6 billion across the country.
Right.
So there is heading towards some kind of situation where there's an equal playing field. Now, the argument I've been making is that, you know, we need to cast the net as wide as possible. So let the housing associations bid for this money, but also let the council bid for this money.
Right.
We can build council housing again, take advantage of these new freedoms, you know, and possibly looking at buying it, you know, getting in a third party necessary to manage the properties.
And are other towns and cities throughout the country trying to do that as well, or is
there? Well, there have been 70 councils that have bid for, you know, this money to build council housing.
And how many have been successful?
70.
All right.
Yeah,
right.
But we are quite rare in that what we're trying to do is a bit obscure. But because it's obscure doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done. In that, because we got rid of our stock, you know, I believe that we should look at building council housing again.
So how many, is there any council housing left in Preston?
There's not one property at the moment, no.
Right, so it's now mainly being bought out by housing associations, which are, I take it, are privately funded companies, aren't
it? It's totally, the social housing stock is totally run by a number of housing associations. They do receive money from central government as well, so they are supported by the central government, but you don't get the democratic accountability with housing associations. I mean, say for example, if someone wanted to get onto me about the fact that the council house was in a mess, I could then go and shout at the director of housing on the council. You can't do that because the board is made up of
trustees.
It's not trustees. I mean, there are five councillors on it, but there are also five officers of the housing association company and also five tenants, you see. So the democratic accountability isn't there strongly, if at all, you know.
So there are positives about it, isn't there? Of having. So what you're saying is, instead of just going back to some old method of, as you would see it being, a more democratic system of housing and the provision of housing, what you're saying is you accept the fact that things have evolved and changed and developed. So therefore, things like Gateway, how, you know, these, where they're doing massive, they seem to be doing a lot of work on the Callan Estate at the moment.
Yeah.
And so they are redeveloping and spending a lot of money and bringing these houses up to a higher standard. What you're saying is, yes, we should have that, but we should also introduce provision for council-run housing, council houses, is that correct?
That's exactly it, Paul. I mean, obviously, from my political perspective, I was not keen on the stock transfer, you know, because, you know, people on my wing of the party do see it as a form of privatisation, which it is in some ways, because, you know, there's private sector involvement, you know, it's not run by local government democratically. But, you know, let's leave the past to the past, and what we have to do is now deal with this massive problem we have within Preston of, you know, at best, 2,000 or 3,000 on the housing waiting list.
Yeah.
At worst, up to 5,000. You know.
So there's 5,000. Sorry, could those figures again? Sorry.
2,000 to 3,000 people.
Yeah.
I mean, the number of indicators. Within Preston, yes. These are people who actually want to live in a social property, whether that's a council.
And where are
property.
They living at the moment?
They're living on probably mainly living within the private sector. Right. But they could also be having difficulties paying the mortgage as well, you know. And these are people who want to move into a social property and pay, a social rent, a reasonable rent.
Yeah.
You know, and there's that few properties available. People are on the list for years.
Right.
You know, so.
And do they stay in? So when they don't have their own home, or be a house, housing association or a council house, if there was council house provision, where are they staying? Are they staying in just hotels and bed and breakfasts, or are they temporary accommodation? Or
yeah, I mean,
there's 3,000 viewers.
A number of them will be, like you say, homeless people who are in temporary accommodation. Well, that'll probably be a minority of people. It's basically people who are probably, paying £500 a month, living in a rented property in the private sector, and they'd rather obviously pay a lot less. Or live in better condition property. So they put themselves on the housing waiting list to get a housing association property. Right. I think it was Shelter that said, across the country there could be 5 million people on a waiting list for either a council housing property or a housing association property. And we're living in the 21st century, the fifth richest country in the world, I just believe it's an economic right and a human right that, in a rich country.
Yeah,
when the banks are being bailed out to the tune of £1.3 trillion, that people should have a right to access a house quickly at an affordable price. I don't think it's asking that much, but we're far away from that at the moment because we have this huge problem with waiting lists. People living in unaffordable housing. And they get into problems with debt and all the rest of it. Family breakdown because of it.
And has that waiting list increased over the last 5 to 10 years?
It has, yeah. I think it used to be about 2,000 in Preston. It's now around 4,000 or 5,000, as I said before.
And as a percentage to the population, as the population increased, has that figure therefore increased quite dramatically? Or
it's bound to have done, isn't it, really? When you think about it,
Indeed. And do you think that has a direct correlation then to this issue of homelessness?
I do. I mean, obviously the issue of homelessness is more complex than that. Obviously, a lot of people who are homeless have, problems with addictions, and there's sometimes young people who have, problems with their parents and they end up on the streets, or there's possibly domestic violence involved in it all. But
the breakup of relationships,
losing
their jobs,
all kinds of things, really. But I think the politicians are getting away from a very simple concept: is that if you want to reduce homelessness, you've got to build more houses. We just don't have enough affordable houses to rent. At the moment, as I said, Shelter was saying that we should have a huge amount of investment in new either council or housing association properties, and they're just not there,
So do you believe, seeing the figures have increased over the last 5 or 10 years, and seeing that there's, although you're lobbying to try and get some council housing back, that hasn't happened yet, has it?
It's not, no.
Right, so if that is not provided, if that provision isn't made, do you, given the way statistics are going at the moment, can you see, therefore, the waiting lists are going to get longer, and in fact the issue of homelessness is actually going to become a larger problem?
It is. I mean, it's a huge problem at the moment, yeah. And the simple thing is we've got to build more houses that people can afford. Very simple concept, isn't it? I can't see how else we can deal with the problem with it unless you provide the houses for people.
Spirits up, we're here tonight, and that's enough. Simply having a wonderful Christmas time. Simply having a wonderful Christmas time. The party's on, the feeling's here, that only comes time of year. Simply having a wonderful Christmas time. Simply having a wonderful Christmas time. The choir of children sing their song.
Do you like being with all your family?
We all gathered together.
Do you do that mainly at the two Eids?
No.
You do it lots of times.
We just went
as soon as it's holiday.
Right.
We went yesterday.
So you love holidays? Holidays make you happy.
But everybody's been annoying.
It's all right. No, I quite like it. It's like it's good life.
It's all right. Sometimes holidays are like, but if it's too many, it gets annoying.
So you actually so enjoy other parts of school that you quite like, about learning things and being with different,
It's a long way.
I like it's Halloween.
You like Halloween?
No, I like
Halloween because fun. I like Halloween because you know what we
scary people come on the door.
Do you know what we thought of at our granddaddy's house? He said we brought some water balloons down before that. Do you know when an alien person comes, we get a water bottle and throw in the face.
So you got water bombs, filled them up, threw them in the face, and did that make you happy?
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. Look at his face.
We never did it on anybody.
So water bombs make you happy?
Yeah, really? We were going to throw them, but we never had enough time.
You never had enough time?
We had to go to
because we were having too much fun.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank. An old man said to me, won't see another one. And then we sang a song, the rare old mountain tune. I turned my face away and dreamed about you. Got on the lucky one, came in late tea. years for me and you. So happy Christmas. I love you, baby. I can see a better time when all our dreams come true. You promised me Broadway was waiting for me. You were handsome.
You were pretty queen of New York City.
When the band finished playing, they held out for more. Sinatra was swinging, all the junk they were singing. We kissed on the corner, then danced through the night. The boys of the NYPD choir were singing, "Go away, babe." And the bells were ringing out for Christmas Day.
I put down with my own. Can't make it all alone. I built my dreams around you.
The boys of the NYPD chorus are singing, "Go away, babe." And the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
In 1945, 6 years of war had left many scars. There was widespread conviction that the war and its horrors had been caused, in large measure, by disregard and contempt for human rights. Society began to think and worry about man, about you and me, our human dignity, our rights. On the 10th of December, 1948, the United Nations General Assembly proclaimed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a standard of achievement to be pursued by all peoples and nations. History records many noble strivings towards the goal of freedom, justice, and peace. There have been many great declarations.
Magna Carta in the year 1215.
The Bill of Rights, 1689.
The American Declaration of Independence, 1776.
The French Declaration of the Rights of Man, 1789.
Historic forward steps, but confined to specific countries and peoples. In 1948, the authors of the new document were agreed. The declaration must be for all peoples. It must be universal. And so the representatives of 58 nations meeting in Paris in the great theater of the Palais de Chaillot voted. As midnight approached, on December 10th, 1948, the Universal Declaration was proclaimed. to remind ourselves of what this declaration is and what it is not, and to refresh our memory of the concepts and ideals which inspired its authors, let's go back to that meeting in the Palais de Chaillot. The speaker is the delegate of the United States and chairman of the UN Human Rights Commission, which had spent 2 years drafting the declaration. Here in the speech she made is the late Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt.
In giving our approval to the declaration today, it is of primary importance that we keep clearly in mind the basic character of the document. It is not a treaty, it is not an international agreement, it is not and does not purport to be a statement of law or of legal obligation. It is a declaration of basic principles of human rights and freedoms, to be stamped with the approval of the General Assembly by formal vote of its members, and to serve as a common standard of achievement for all peoples of all nations. We stand today at the threshold of a great event, both in the life of the United Nations and in the life of mankind.
Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight. Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight. Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight. Merry Christmas, I don't want to.
Well, welcome everyone, and here we are, it's Friday the 9th of October, and I have with me Michael Lavelas. He is an independent socialist councillor for the Town Centre Ward in Preston, and an associate professor in social work at Liverpool Hope University. Hi Michael.
Hiya.
Can you tell me what is, you know, almost like a brief definition of what racism is?
Okay, well, I mean, that's quite a difficult question, but if you were to put that as simply as possible, I think it is the belief that the world is divided up into different races, that you have black races, brown races, yellow races, white races, that there's a notion of hierarchy that goes with that, and on the basis of that hierarchical notion of the world being divided into races, some political activity falls on that discriminates against those who are seen to be, in inverted commas, from a lower race.
Yeah.
So very simply, that's what I think racism is.
And where that particular idea, because we were talking about before about Darwinism and things, when did that really start to become manifest, those ideas? Because we're not talking a long period of history here, are we?
No. People often think that we've always seen the world in terms of different races and different countries and different nations. Actually, countries, nations, seeing the world in terms of different races are relatively recent historical phenomena. Now, we're talking 300, 400 years, so a long time, but in the history of humanity, a relatively short time. And actually, both things develop with the rise of modern capitalism, with the modern world. Nation-states didn't exist before modern capitalism. And modern capitalism itself developed on the back of the slave trade, the Golden Triangle, which Britain was centrally involved in, where ships went from Glasgow, where I come from Preston, from Liverpool, from Bristol, from London, down to the African coast, where they picked up slaves, and then went to the Caribbean, where they picked up cotton and sugar, and back up into Britain. That Golden Triangle was the fueling basis of the modern capitalist world that we understand. And to justify that, people started to interpret the world in terms of different races, and in particular, as a justification for African slavery, of seeing that black people from Africa were inferior, a subspecies to white people. So it's got a 300, 400 year history, but in terms of the entire history of humanity, it's not always been the case that we have seen the world in terms of races or difference in this way. And therefore, racism and capitalism are, you know, two sides of the same coin, really. Before racism, before capitalism, we still had incredibly unequal societies and hierarchical societies. Before capitalism in Europe, we had feudalism. At the top of the feudal haystack, if you like, was two pinnacles. One was the Pope and the Church and his relationship with God, and the other one was kings. And at the bottom, as there is in under capitalism, where the vast majority of us who in those days were peasants and now are workers. But so the history of unequal societies is much, much older than that.
Right.
The history of unequal societies is much, much older than race and notions of racism. They've shaped humanity for thousands upon thousands of years.
Yeah.
Different types of unequal societies, different types of societies, but inequality has been there in different forms for considerably longer than racism. But there's an important thing there. you know, I believe that we should try to strive for a world where there are getting rid of all inequalities.
Absolutely.
But people sometimes say it's impossible to get rid of racism and race because it's been there for such a long time. Actually, racism is the newcomer on the block. Yeah. And the majority of human societies, there was no racism, it should be easy to establish a world where there is no racism again. Right. Inequalities, longer. Power, hierarchies, longer history, but it's still possible to change these things.
So that's a definition of racism. What would you say is a definition of fascism?
Well, fascism is a particular political philosophy which grew up in the 20th century. The keynote of fascism is that obviously the first significant fascist state was in Italy. And the first focus of all fascist organisations throughout the 20th century was the organised labour movement. That was their first hostile orientation. It was collective welfare provision, it was collective community organisations, it was trade union organisations. Mussolini came to power in Italy because he was able to use his armed guards to smash up people who were in strike. Right. The same with the Nazis in Germany. The first people that they attacked were the communists, the trade unionists, the socialists, the left. So fascism is a particular political project which has as its goal the stabilisation of capitalism in times of economic crisis at the expense of working class organisations. Since the 1930s, however, it has also had within it a very strong trend of eugenicism, of notion that there is racial hierarchy and superiority.
Which comes back to what we were saying
and comes
before.
Back therefore to racism. And obviously for the Nazis, that was about anti-Semitism, and the lowest of the low for the Nazis in the 1930s Germany were the Jews. The focus of that has changed for modern day Nazis in Britain. It's the Muslim community. In Eastern Europe, it's the Roma. And behind that, for many Nazis, even in Britain and across Europe, it still remains the Jewish population.
Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight with...
And good evening, everyone. And it's Wednesday, the 7th of October, and it's 7:30. And I am at the Raza Mosque on St. Paul's Road. Actually, the mosque name, as it were, it's not the original name, is it? The original Islamic word for it?
It's masjid. It's masjid, yes.
Yep.
In Europe, masjids are known as mosque. It's a European term, but the correct
Islamic term,
spiritual term, is masjid. That's
okay,
correct.
Brilliant. And I have with me Naeem, who was just speaking then.
Yeah. Asalaamu Alaikum.
Atiq.
Wa Asalaamu Alaikum.
Nasir Hussain.
Asalaamu Alaikum.
And Basharat.
Asalaamu Alaikum.
And Basharat, you're the secretary of... yes,
of Raza Masjid, yes.
Yes. And Nasir, you're the president of the mosque. And Atiq and Naeem, you're...
I'm a committee member, yeah.
Yes, yeah, fantastic, indeed. Now then, could Naeem, could you just explain to me, because it's quite important here as well, the actual history of the mosque here on St. Paul's Road, the Rosa Mosque.
Rosa Masjid was opened December 20th, 1970.
Yep.
It was the first unique facility of its kind to be opened in England. At the time, there was a masjid. A masjid is a term for a place of worship.
Yep.
A madrasa is a term for a place of education, such as a school, a schooling facility. This, the masjid and madrasa, the Raza Masjid and Madrasa, were opened as a unique facility, the first of its type, back in 1970 by our grandparents when they came from the subcontinent as economic migrants.
Yep.
And they wanted to continue their practice of their faith.
Yep.
And they wanted to pass on the knowledge, the sacred knowledge of Islam, onto obviously their children at the time, and who wanted to continue passing that knowledge on to their children and so forth and so forth.
Right. And when you, so that was 39 years ago?
That's correct, yeah.
And as we spoke earlier, you said that the, so then when it was first built, and that's the first one ever built in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
The actual reaction of the people themselves from Preston and Lancashire, that was quite a positive one, wasn't it?
Speaking to the elders over the years, the reaction of seeing a masjid initially was one of curiosity and of intrigue.
Yeah.
And there was a very good reaction. The local community engaged itself with the then elders of the Islamic community.
Yeah.
The opening of the masjid attracted media attention, local media, national media, and I believe European media.
Yeah, which it would do.
Which it would do, because it's a unique facility of its own kind, one of a kind. And the general reaction, my understanding, is that it was a very positive reaction in the community.
Right. So even though predominantly within Preston at the time, which of course is known as Priest Town.
That's right,
You know, this would be the first mosque, and of course, with the architecture that's used, you know, it's the first dome, you know, it's got a lot of the original, authentic sort of architectural designs within it.
Yeah.
Surrounded, I would imagine, with, and there's still quite a lot left of, as it were, Christian churches.
Yeah.
That was actually welcomed and was celebrated in a way.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, that's a perfect attempt to put it. It was celebrated in a way.
That's fantastic, yeah.
It was celebrated more in the fact that the one that was built in the late 1800s in Woking in Surrey was actually built by a sultan, was it?
A sultan, yeah, that's
sultan.
Right.
And this was actually built by the actual migrant workers that actually came over from the subcontinent.
Actually the community. Whereas the one that brother...
when did the community start growing in Preston and in Lancashire? When did the... What period of time? And what
I think even before, if we look at the people from India and Pakistan were engaged in the British Army as soldiers in the Second World War, and even if we go back to the First World War, they've been always part of the British community.
Yeah.
Because as... If we look at British history, the British Empire expanded to as far as India, and we were part of a community then.
Yep.
And when the Second World War ended, there was opportunities here in the UK for the existing people that were in the armed forces and their families, and then opportunities
and
arose.
So as well,
And rightly so, of course.
Yep.
Many Asians, Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus gave their lives for Britain, for the British Empire.
Yep.
And so a lot of people aren't aware of this, but it's a fact.
Yep.
People started arriving in the 50s, in the 60s, because the economic climate in the UK had improved, and there were no workers to do the tedious menial tasks. There was no people to do the menial tasks.
Yep.
So what there was an invite to people to do menial tasks in the UK.
Which was about also good for the government, because then that boosts the...
Of course.
Much.
What they had was, they had work, but they had no workforce at the time.
Yep.
There was a migration of economic migrants that arrived in the UK. They brought with them their own culture. They tried in their best way to fit in with the existing culture.
Yep.
And one of the ways they fitted in, and we could see that they were fitting in, is the development of a masjid and madrasa like Raza Masjid, because obviously with the development and the building of a facility, there must have been an engagement of communities, of the Christian community, of the non-religious community and the religious community, for it to develop, because you've got the council involved, you've got the government involved, you've got a variety of communities involved. So just the result of the Masjid and Madrasa shows an engagement of all communities. So it must have been a good time at that time.
bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. What fun to ride and sing in a one-horse open sleigh. Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh. O'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. Bells on bobtail ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is. Ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh. O'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. Bells on bobtail ring, making spirits bright. Oh, what fun to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Oh, we have a lot of fun.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Jingle bells, oh what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Talking about black sheep, as we were saying before, Nate, I was sent this email yesterday. And it said last week, 20 Muslim grand. I mean, it's starting to get really, you know, some of these acts and stuff like this are becoming sort of quite disgusting in a way. But last week, 20 Muslim graves were attacked in the Southern Cemetery in Chorlton, an area of Manchester. Nothing like this has ever happened here, explained Abdul at a vigil at the cemetery last Sunday. It is no coincidence the English Defence League are coming to Manchester next Saturday. The English Defence League are an anti-Muslim group of thugs. They have taken their race-hate message to Luton, Birmingham and to a mosque in Harrow. The EDL tried to attack the Palestine demonstration in London last month. And they have emailed group, the Stop the War Coalition in Manchester, threatening them to keep away, and they're continuously intimidating. So now they're starting to attack Muslim graves.
Yeah.
They're continuously... I mean, sure, by the looks of it then, their objective, their aims and objective is to go to war in some way? Do they want bloodshed on the streets?
I don't think they actually want bloodshed on the streets. I think maybe their objective is to cause as much trouble as possible. But as my brother here was saying earlier, in terms of black sheep, we have in every community, we have a middle ground and we have an extreme ground in every community.
Yep.
We find that, obviously, this is an extreme
reaction
or extreme action by an extreme set of people.
Yeah.
What we can do for them is we can pray for them.
Yeah.
Is one of the things. Yeah. We can pray that God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, opens our hearts. And sure, what are you doing attacking graves? What is all that about?
Yeah.
It's the dead.
Yeah.
At least respect the dead.
Yeah.
If you've got something to say, go on a platform and say it on a platform.
Maybe they don't have the courage to do that.
Maybe it's possible. Maybe that's very, very accurate. Yeah. But what we do have, fortunately, in the UK is an excellent policing system.
Yeah.
And what we as Muslims have found that the police are excellent when it comes to dealing with situations like that. So we do not need to engage ourselves as a Muslim community in people or with people like themselves who are behaving in a terrible manner.
Do you believe it's in the small minority?
We believe it is a small minority.
What do you necessarily, you were going to say?
Well,
something
I think
that?
Basically some of them people like just stir things up, like so the other community react, and then justifies their whatever they're trying to achieve.
Well, what is it do you think they're trying to achieve?
Well, I think they're trying to achieve, like, just to get into politics and basically, you know, have their own...
Further their own aims.
Yeah. I think you can ask them what they're trying to achieve.
Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight. Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight. Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight.
Frieda, what makes you happy?
It's listening to my great-grandchildren and the sayings and thinking, well, not how clever they are, but I think they were born before.
Right.
They've been born before. They come out with some of the most funniest things that I've ever heard, and I really do laugh at them.
Right, excellent. What else makes you happy?
What makes me happy? Being at home, and being quiet and everything. A lot of people think it's being lonely. I love being in my own house and
right.
thoroughly enjoying it. I do enjoy again bingo too.
Right, okay.
There's such a lot of things that really do make me happy.
Okay. On the other hand, what makes you sad or angry?
What makes me sad? Because in my mind, I can still do things. I get up and try to do them, and I can't.
Is that because your body won't let you do it?
Because my body won't, mind you, I'm 89.
Right.
My body, in my mind, I can still do things. And then when I try to do them, now that makes me sad.
So do you feel as young as you used to do, apart from your body maybe not feeling
in it? My mind I am, yes.
Right.
And then I can go back and think about the wonderful holidays I've had. Makes and that can make me... We can have a laugh about it, the things I've done.
Policing policy then for dealing with the people who are homeless in Preston?
It's very, very wide ranging.
Yeah.
We work with
all the other agencies in Preston. We yeah. are one of the agencies that is involved in the Home of the Strategy.
And you go to all the forum meetings.
Go to the forum meetings, absolutely. Yeah. And again, talking about short-term, medium-term, long-term, our ultimate aim is to work with the other agencies to get homelessness down to a minimum in Preston.
Yeah.
Because, as with criminals, what our ultimate aim is for the people that are homeless or the criminals, obviously two separate sets of people, our ultimate aim is to get them on the right road, if you like, and yeah. get them settled in a home and get them happy and you know, sorted
empowered
out, really.
In their own lives.
Empowering their own lives. Our aim isn't to arrest people or to move people on or anything like that.
Yeah.
Our aim is to get those people back on the feet working with the other agencies.
Yeah.
Obviously, as police, our job is to enforce the law
yeah.
and to keep peace within Preston City Centre and allow Preston City Centre to be somewhere people come and they see a nice, tidy, clean city. And when they're shopping or they're going to the car parks or walking about, they actually feel safe and reassured.
Yeah.
We don't harass homeless people or really have a great deal of dealings with people unless
yeah.
we get a call from the public
yeah.
saying that they're causing a problem or they're in an area where we've had complaints from businesses that may complain about homeless people or beggars or... people that are sort of gathering in an area and they're intimidating other people or they're drinking
yeah.
or they're causing problems. So
yeah.
we don't go actively seeking out homeless people
yeah.
To harass them, which I think is probably a common misconception.
Well, that's what I've been... Some of the homeless people are saying that.
Sure.
I mean, this seems to be on the increase as well, isn't it? Certain other businesses now, as Preston Town Centre is being more renovated,
mm-hmm.
more investment is made... The tolerance levels
mm-hmm.
For this small group of homeless people that actually, you know, exist in the Preston Town Centre, they would say that they are getting more.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some more complaints are being made to the police,
yes.
and the homeless people are saying to me that they are receiving more
mm-hmm.
sort of moving on instructions or more
sure.
harassment.
Well, I think the issue for us is that we, as well as getting crimes coming in on a daily basis,
mm.
I also review antisocial behaviour calls that come in every day, and I look at every single one of those as well.
Yeah.
And we get complaints from the public about
yeah.
people who are... It's difficult to encompass homeless people and beggars within the same, because not all homeless people beg. But
yeah.
we certainly get complaints from the public
yeah.
about certain people gathering in areas... maybe on drugs, maybe consuming alcohol, and
yeah.
maybe intimidating. For example, somebody may be sleeping on the multi-storey car park.
Yeah.
Perhaps a lady on her own at night comes back to get in her car and might feel intimidated or fearful if somebody shouts abuse or says anything or is
or
drunk.
Or in fact just wakes up.
Or just,
or it's just
in fact wakes up.
Yeah.
So we have to... The balance for us is quite difficult because we are really conscious of the human side of working with the other agencies and really helping homeless people, and that is our ultimate aim,
yeah.
to get people back on the, you know, as you said, to empower their own lives and get them off the streets.
Yeah.
But we also have to enforce the law, and if the public are complaining of intimidation or fear
yeah.
or antisocial behaviour, then we have to deal with that.
Right.
Because that's our duty, that's our fundamental duty, to
yeah.
make the streets of Preston safe, okay, and make people feel safe. So we do move people on
yeah.
if they're in a situation where people are suffering those consequences. It hasn't increased.
Do you think it's... I know this is what the feedback
of,
is. That
the level of calls is probably one of our biggest problems in the city centre. It's probably the most prolific problem in terms of antisocial behaviour within the city centre. The amount of calls we get reflects that.
Right.
I'd say it was reducing, if anything, because
right.
of the things we've got in place with the other agencies.
Yeah.
So that's, if you like, the negative side of what we do, because we have to do that because that's our fundamental role. It's to
yeah.
keep the peace,
yeah.
Maintain the Queen's peace and make people feel safe and reassured within Preston City Centre.
Yeah.
We also do a great deal with the other agencies, and we also do a great deal to help homeless people in terms of operations we've run, multi-agency operations we've run,
yeah,
where we've provided support, we've provided clothing, clean-up kits, grooming kits, and advice. If we come across a homeless person, we give them information about how they can, the agencies that they can access to help, yeah, them. We're very conscious of, we've referred people into different agencies, we've referred people to Fox Street, we work with the Emmaus Project, the Recycling Lives Project, we go, yeah, to regular meetings with these agencies through Fox Street. So we constantly work with the agencies to try and get people to work with those agencies to get them off the street.
So the policies and that you have at the moment, do you think they're working?
I think they are, for many, many people. As we've discussed already, there'll be people that, you know, just won't engage,
yeah,
and they're difficult. We're not in the business, and neither of the other agencies we work with are forcing anything on anybody.
You can't.
We're not allowed to. And there will always be people that won't access those services and won't engage with people. And yeah, as I've said, it's just a case of being there and having that contact with them. Hopefully one day they may want to change and want to understand, you know, they've had problems in the past and they may be addicted to drugs or alcohol,
yeah,
and that's their primary aim in life, is to fund that habit and, right, to, you know, kill whatever pain they may have, etc. So all we can do is keep engaging with them and supporting them as best we can,
yeah,
but there will always be those people. But to say, is it working, then it obviously is working, because there are cases where, several cases I can think of, where people have been referred to Recycling Lives or referred to Fox Street,
yeah,
who goes to the Foxton Centre, have actually, you know, rebuilt their lives, and that is just so heartwarming. That is exactly what we all want.
Yes, indeed.
And that is working. So it is working.
Yeah.
It doesn't appear to be working in some cases when we still get the antisocial behaviour calls coming in.
Yeah.
And people still feel intimidated, but that's our role.
A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away is the bluebird, here to stay is a new bird. He sings a love song as we go along, walking in a winter wonderland. In the meadow we can build a snowman, then pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, I am married, we'll say, no, ma'am. But you can do the job when you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by the fire, to face unafraid the plans that we made, walking in a winter wonderland. Over the ground lies a mantle of white, a heaven of diamonds in the lovely night.
And she holds my head up high. Don't you ever let anybody put you down, cause you are my little angel. Then she makes something warm for me to drink, cause it's cold out there, she thinks.
Then she walks
me to school, that's why I ain't no fool. I just think my mom is amazing. She makes me feel like I can do anything. And when she's with me, there's nowhere else I'd rather be. After school, she's waiting by the gates. I'm so happy that I just can't wait to get home to tell her how my day went. Eat the yummy food only my mom makes. Then I wind her up cause I don't want to bath. And we run around the house with a laugh. No matter what I say, she gets away. I just think my mom is amazing. She makes me feel like I can do anything. And when she's with me, there's nowhere else I'd rather be. She tucks me into bed, and we run our wraps around her head. Then she tells me a tale of a girl far away who one day became a princess. I'm so happy, I don't want her to leave. So she lies in bed with me. As I close my eyes, how lucky am I to have a mom so amazing. Would be amazing.
That's brilliant. Well done. That's going to sound great on the radio. Well, what a show that was. Thank you to all the people involved and all the people actually that run Preston FM themselves, all the volunteers and the workers and everything.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Who've given us an opportunity for actually doing this show. It's been great, actually. You know, and all the different people, be it in the community centres and or on the streets or whatever, it's been fantastic. I've really enjoyed it. Have you, Des?
I've certainly enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. And what we'd like to do is we'd just like to give you, you know, seeing it's Christmas, we'd like to sing a little sort of song. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. See you next year.